Three movements here in the sermon. One is that Jesus wept. Jesus wept. Second, is Jesus saying, I am the resurrection. And the third is that he commands the people, unbind him. So let's look at them one by one. First of all, Jesus wept. When Jesus finally arrives in Bethany, Lazarus has been in the tomb for 4 days. And the family had been grieving for a while, and they've had some time for the new reality to start sinking in. And so Mary and Martha, Lazarus's sisters, they're surrounded by all these mourners. And Martha runs to meet Jesus and says, what we all want to say, when you feel like God has arrived too late, right? God didn't show up and he didn't save the day. And so she comes and she says to Jesus, Lord, if you had been here, my brother wouldn't have died. Now, this is a statement of faith, but it's also an accusation, isn't it? Notice Jesus doesn't get defensive about it. He doesn't rebuke Martha. When you read through the Psalms, there are many Psalms that sound very similar. Psalms that say, God, why aren't you doing anything? God, why are you so far away when we are suffering? Why are you so far when justice is being miscarried, when evil seems to be winning the day? And God doesn't just want nice, religiously correct prayers. You see, he doesn't want these tiny, tidy prayers that we can give to him reverently. He is welcoming, he's inviting honest prayers from the depths of our hearts. This is why the Psalms are in the Scriptures. And so Jesus takes the prayer or the accusation of Martha, doesn't rebuke her, but he makes his way to where the other sister Mary is. And she comes and she falls at his feet with the exact same words. She says to him, if you had been here, my brother wouldn't have died. So he looks at her weeping and at the mourners who are weeping with her. And we read something that should arrest us. It's extraordinary because in verse 33, we read, he was deeply moved in spirit and troubled. And then in verse 35, it says, Jesus wept. Verse 35, in the Greek, it's just one word. It's the shortest verse in the Bible. And some of you know that from your Sunday school, right? Yet, if you think about this, theologically, it's revolutionary. The word that's translated deeply moved is the Greek embrimaomai. It describes turbulence. It describes an agitation. Excuse me. Commentators say it's the same word that's used for a horse that's snorting before a battle. When the horse is overcome with excitement and is struggling with fear, and that tells us that Jesus isn't like the pictures that we might have of, say, like Buddha. There's all this suffering and there's all this turmoil, but Buddha is serene and unmoved by grief and death and human troubles. Instead, Jesus is presented in a very different way. He's stirred. He's stirred mightily. He's disturbed mightily at our grief. And the word troubled is tarasso, the same word that's used for Jesus, again, in a couple of chapters later. He's in the Garden of Gethsemane, and he's struggling. He is struggling before he goes to the cross, and he says, Father, if it's your will, let this cup pass from me. And he's struggling, and is in such great turmoil that he even sweats blood. This is genuine turmoil that Jesus is experiencing. And John says this in the first chapter of John. He says, the Word became flesh and blood. Meaning, the Logos that created all things holds all things together shockingly, surprisingly, enters into the full experience of what it means for us to be us, into our messy grief, into our sin, into our troubles, into our death. Here's a question that this passage forces us to wrestle with. Why does Jesus weep? He already knows what he's about to do. He even told his disciples as much before they left. He said, this sickness will not end in death. He knows he's going to raise up Lazarus in a few minutes. Yet, Jesus weeps. Why? The only answer is that he enters into our grief fully. No reservations, no holds barred. This is what the Christian doctrine of incarnation means. Because we believe in a God who is incarnate. He became flesh and blood and lived among us. God doesn't just visit us from a privileged, glorious distance. You know, like a visiting head of state in a motorcade. They come through and they can go right past all of us, suffering rabble. It doesn't come visiting us like a religious figure in a bulletproof glass encased podium. God descends all the way down into our muck and mire to be with us fully, into the tears, into the heartbreak, into the 4 days gone, darkness and decay. He comes all the way down. And so there's a long tradition in Christianity, that is shocked by how God gets portrayed, like this. We want to protect God's dignity, we want to protect his holiness. And so we want to keep him at a distance from human suffering. And the Son of God becoming overcome with grief at our pain, that would be a weakness. But John doesn't do that. He uses the strongest language possible to describe what's happening with Jesus at the tomb. God in the flesh isn't untouched or unmoved by your losses. He is overcome by them, and he weeps over them. Some of you, you have experienced recent losses of loved ones. Or you are living today in the shadow of loved ones who are lost. It might have been sometime in the past, but it's casting a shadow over you. You're living in the shadow of that, and there you might be living with dashed hopes, broken dreams of what might have been, relationships that turned into estrangements, and you're living with the sorrow. You're living with the hardships that this is not the way that you expected things to be, and you're living with the uncertainty about what might come next. We are all of us either living with loss, or we will live with loss. Grief and loss and uncertainty, part of what it means to live here on earth, isn't it? If you've been in the church for a long time, you know that we sometimes think that being mature in faith means we should be past all of these things. We should be past grief. If we are mature, we think it means we can keep a stiff upper lip. You're not moved. If we break down, if we stumble, if we struggle, we wonder, am I lacking trust? Am I lacking faith? If you're going through hardships and if you're going through losses, we wonder, has God abandoned me? Has God said, I'm not going to deal with this loser anymore? We struggle with this, but Jesus himself wept, and this is good news. Grief is not a failure of faith. It's a godly, honest response to real loss. We live in a world that's waiting for its redemption. We live in a world that is not yet healed and is still broken. It's still under the tyranny of sin and death. You go watch the news, and every day we see how broken our world is. This world is still not the way that it's supposed to be. This world, Paul says this in Romans chapter 8, is groaning. It's groaning every day along with us for the day when every tear will be wiped away. Until then, it is right for us to shed tears. It is right for us to grieve. Because Jesus wept. The Jesus who is being presented to us in the scriptures, thank you, is not the God of the Bette Midler song, the song that says, God is watching us from a distance. That song came out during the first Gulf War, and it gave comfort to a lot of people. You know, and they said, oh, you know, God is watching us from a distance. At least God knows something about the fears and the anxieties that we're experiencing. But the Jesus of the Bible is so different from this distant God who kind of winds up the universe and then walks away. Instead, he comes near. He comes so near that he shares all of our pain intimately, descends into all of our turmoil and our grief, and stands at the tomb of his friend, knowing what comes next, and yet he's still overcome with weeping. Anyway, to him, your experience isn't something that some stranger goes through. It's what he shares with you, intimately. Now, here's what changes when you're with the one who is resurrection himself in the midst of your grief. The Apostle Paul says this in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verse 13. He says, brothers and sisters, I do not want you to be uninformed about those who sleep in death, so that you do not grieve like the rest of mankind who have no hope. Notice what he doesn't say. He doesn't say, don't grieve. You know Jesus saved you, right? Don't grieve. No, he says, do grieve. But do not grieve as those who have no hope. The grief is real. Paul expects it, but it's a grief that's different in its quality. Why? Because now it's been transformed. It's been transformed by hope. Christian grief is not the same as hopeless grief, even though it might look similar on the outside. Grief without hope, it circles in on itself. It has no destination. It loops around because there's nowhere for it to go. If death is the final word, loss is ultimately meaningless. And because life is filled with losses, life then becomes meaningless. But grief, in light of resurrection, has a horizon. Doesn't mean that it's fake. It still hurts. Jesus doesn't cancel out the pain. Yet, because he is who he is, the grief is no longer sealed. It's open at one end. The darkness is real, but it's not the final reality. The resurrection person who is now with you is the final reality. So that's what it means, not to grieve as those who have no hope. It's not stoicism. It's not pretending that the loss is not that bad. It means rather grieving in the presence of somebody who himself is resurrection. That makes all of the difference in the world. Now you can grieve with a sure hope. Be sad. Let yourself experience the pain and the loss. But know that one day all your tears will be wiped away because the one who is resurrection and life walks with you right now. He is present. Jesus wept with the sisters and then he called. So the descent is real, but it has a direction. Another destination. I want us to see that this is a pattern for us in the Christian life. There's no denial of death, but there's death and there's resurrection, right? And so, as we descend together, we'll also rise together. Death has to come before resurrection, but we have to be willing to descend. We have to be willing to descend first. The invitation here is not to keep ourselves safe in the distance, to stay on the sidelines, right? From Jesus, from one another, from what's really happening inside our own hearts and in our lives and within this community. The invitation is to join Jesus and to weep with those who weep and go to the tomb with Jesus. So this text makes a demand of us, doesn't it? Not just an offer. If Jesus, who already knew the ending, who held resurrection in his own hand, chose to enter fully into the grief of Mary and Martha, then we who follow him are also called to do the same for each other. Jesus entering into grief isn't just for the purpose of sentimental value in a Hollywood production. It's a real-life model for our own discipleship. The problem is, when we encounter people who are grieving, we tend to default to something that's much more comfortable. We tend to default to politeness. We tend to give space. Maybe we give a wide berth to grieving people. We worry about saying the wrong thing. So we keep a respectable distance. We send a card, we offer nice sentiments, and quietly move on. We mean well, but we default to distance when what's needed is presence. Look at what Jesus does. He doesn't send thoughts and prayers in the direction of the tomb from a safe distance. He asks to be taken there. He stands in the middle of all of the weeping. He lets himself be overcome and break down. He enters into our sorrows. And what the grieving person most needs is exactly that. Not space, but friends. Someone who's willing to go to the hard places with them. To sit in the darkness without rushing to resolve it. Somebody who will, as Paul says, weep with those who weep. This is countercultural, you know, because our instinct, shaped by a world that's deeply uncomfortable with grief, is to manage it from a safe distance. But the church is called to be different, called to be a community that doesn't flinch from the tomb, doesn't shy away from the death and from the grief, that doesn't leave the grieving to be alone by themselves, that descends together precisely because the church trusts the one who descended and rose again. We have a hope, you see. This matters not just for the church, you know, not just for us in here. The world is full of people who are grieving alone, who are carrying their losses by themselves with no community to hold them, with no horizon of hope, no one willing to enter the darkness with them. A church that's learned, that's discipled in weeping together and leading one another towards resurrection hope is something that our world desperately needs. All right, here's the second movement. Jesus who says, I am the resurrection. So let's go back a bit in our passage to this exchange between Jesus and Martha, because this is the theological heart of this passage. So Martha accuses him, if you had been here, and Jesus tells her, your brother will rise again. Martha agrees. She knows her doctrine. She says, I know that he will rise again in the resurrection at the last day. It's right doctrine, right theology. But Jesus says something that reframes everything. He says, I am the resurrection and the life. The one who believes in me will live, even though they die, and whoever lives by believing in me will never die. Do you believe this? Not, I will bring about resurrection someday. Not, there's going to be a resurrection that is coming, but I am the resurrection. Now, this is the fifth of the seven great I am statements in John's gospel. This is a deliberate echo of God's name that was revealed to Moses at the burning bush. Remember the story? You know, and Moses asked God, you know, who shall I say sent me? And it says, the great I am who I am has sent you. Yahweh, the self-existing one. And here, Jesus takes that name and attaches it to resurrection. He's saying, Martha, you have the right doctrine, but do you understand the one who is with you right now? Do you believe in the resurrection, not just as a future event, but can you encounter the resurrection as a present person? Same question that's being posed to us today. This is where the encounter takes on a surprising turn, because if you've been a Christian for a while, the great danger is familiarity. You know, we relate to resurrection as a doctrine that we affirm rather than a person that we know. We can have correct theology and still be living as though Jesus is only relevant for a future event. You know, only relevant at the end when the story wraps up. And this passage calls us back to the person of Jesus. He's not only the one who is going to raise the dead. Eventually, he is the resurrection here and now, present in the middle of all that you're going through. right? In the midst of your grief, in the midst of your uncertainty, in the midst of all of your transitions, the surprise here is not new information, it's a new encounter with somebody that you thought that you already knew. Jesus asks Martha and us this question that runs beneath everything that we've been talking about. Do you believe this? Do you believe? And Martha's response is a wonderful one. It's a human one. She doesn't claim perfect understanding. She doesn't even know what's about to happen, what Jesus is about to do, but she confesses what she believes. Yes, Lord, I believe that you're the Messiah, the Son of God, who is to come into the world. It's a model of faith that this passage is inviting us into. It's not certainty about how God is going to act. We don't know exactly what he will do, but we trust in the one who is himself, the resurrection, and is with us now, present. Here's the third movement of the sermon. Jesus says, unbind him. So we come to the moment that the whole passage has been building towards. Jesus stands before the tomb, tells them to roll away the stone, and Martha objects, Lord, by this time there is a bad odor, for he has been there for 4 days. 4 days, meaning beyond hope, by any natural measure. But Jesus simply says, didn't I tell you that if you believe, you will see the glory of God? So the stone is rolled away. And Jesus prays, notably not for himself, but for the sake of the crowd, so that they may believe. All of this is geared for us, so that we might believe. Then he cries out, Lazarus, come out. And the dead man walks out of the tomb. Now, this is the seventh and the climactic sign in John's gospel before the cross. And it's not lost on John that this miracle becomes the trigger for the religious leader's decision to kill Jesus. If you keep on reading in the passage, they see what Jesus has done. And the chief priests and the Pharisees, they call a council together. They call a meeting. And they say, what are we accomplishing? If we let him go on like this, then everybody will believe in him. And so they decide right there and then that he must die. The one who gives life to Lazarus will go on now to lay down his life. Resurrection is not only a power that he wields, it's also the path that he walks. I want us to stay with this very last thing. Jesus says in this passage, Lazarus emerges and is still wrapped in burial clothes. Hands, feet, face, it's all bound. So Jesus tells the people around him, take off the grave clothes and let him go. Unbind him. Jesus performs this resurrection, this miracle alone, but he enlists the community to complete it. The grave clothes have to come off, and that's not something that Lazarus can do for himself. That's something that the people around him have to do together for him. You know, this detail isn't here by accident. John wants us to see how resurrection works in the life of a community. Some of us, we've experienced something of a new life. You know, we've had a real encounter with Jesus. The turning point in life. We've got a new season of genuine hope. And yet, you can still feel the grave clothes still clinging on. You know, old grief, old identities, old habits, old ways of seeing ourselves that belong to a chapter that's already been closed. We've experienced new life, but we're still not walking free. We're standing in the doorway of the tomb, but we're still wrapped in grave clothes. Lazarus, he can't unwrap himself. He needs a community to do it. See, resurrection is not a solitary project. We need one another to complete it. It's a community project. I'm not saying that Jesus needs our help to accomplish salvation, right? I am not saying that we are somehow helping him to redeem, but I am saying that Jesus invites his church to know the joy and the honor of participating in his work of redemption and his work of resurrection that only he can carry out. And he invites us into this. You know what this means? It means that we need to be the kind of community where what kind of work is possible. Where somebody can say, you know, I still am carrying something that doesn't belong to me anymore. And there are people here that I can lean on to help me to get free. A community like that requires mutual trust. It requires us showing up for each other. It requires being the kind of church that doesn't keep each other at an arm's length, especially in this messy in-between places. In a season of transition, this really matters, doesn't it? You know, transitions mean that people are still in the doorway. You know, not quite in the new place, not quite out of the old place, not sure what you should get rid of, not sure what you should bring with you. What it means for us to be a faith community in those moments is what Jesus told the people around Lazarus: get close, unbind him, free him up. And we are being invited to do that for each other. And this is the other side of the first invitation, which was descend together. Don't stand on the sidelines when somebody is suffering. The invitation now is to be also be present for the rising. Do not leave somebody alone in this in-between place, still wrapped in burial clothes, technically out of the grave, but not yet fully free. We're being called to help each other become unbound from all of the vestiges of sin and death. And this is going to be what life in the church is about, right? We're helping each other to get free from each other. And then notice how our own suffering gets transformed if we turn it into an occasion of ministry. Because you know, why do you go through? Don't you ask God that? Why did I go through what I went through? You know, why did God allow me to go through that and go through that experience? I wish that God didn't. You're in a position, friend, to be able to help somebody else who's going through that exact same thing. Resurrection. It's been raised to new life. As we descend together, we rise together. That's the calling of the church. We go to the tomb together. We weep together. We hear the voice of the risen one together, and we help one another out of the grave clothes because we know the one who is resurrection, and we've learned from him what it means to enter into each other's sorrows, into each other's losses, and then also into each other's joys and experience the resurrection of Jesus here and now. Encounters with Jesus tend to surprise us. You might have expected the miracle worker to arrive before the death so that he can keep things from getting this dark, this sad. Instead, he arrives 4 days too late. But he weeps at the tomb, and he raises the dead in a way that enters into our grief, reveals his identity, and summons the community into action. We're headed towards Easter. In a few weeks, we're going to come face to face with an empty tomb that's far more significant than Lazarus's tomb. Lazarus would die again, because what happened to him was a sign of something that's greater to come. His resurrection was a sign that pointed to the cross and to the resurrection of Jesus. The one who called Lazarus out of the grave would go in himself and would come out on the other side, and he would open up a door for all of creation to pass through into a brand new world. Don't miss this. Lazarus is raised, and because of that, Jesus dies. The resurrection of Lazarus sets in motion a chain of events that will end with the crucifixion of Jesus. Jesus knew this and raised Lazarus anyway. Do you see the significance of that? We get raised to new life, which means Jesus must go to the cross. This is why Jesus came. This is why he descended into our sorrows and into our loss, why he descended even into our death. He came so that you and I could be raised to a new day that will never end, so that we can have him who is resurrection and life with us forever. Do you believe this? This story prepares us for Easter by asking us to encounter Jesus not simply as a doctrine or a historical figure, but as the living one who stays with you, present through your greatest pain, through your greatest loss, and says, "I am the resurrection and the life." Do you believe this? If you've been in church all your life, let that question land fresh today. It's possible to have carried the right answers your whole life, and you still need an encounter with the person. If you're still exploring faith, you're still deciding, this weeping tomb visiting, grave clothes removing Jesus, this is the one that you are being invited to trust. Not a safe, distant God, but the one who came all the way down to the muck and mire and the tears in order to be with you and to lead you out to new life. For all of us, in this in-between season, you are not alone. We are going through death and resurrection with Jesus and together with each other because Jesus is resurrection and life. Because he's with us in our sorrows and in our joys, we will rise together. We will see new creation on the other side together. Do not weep as those who do not have any hope. He is resurrection and life. Let's pray. Lord Jesus, you are the resurrection and the life. Jesus, we come to you as Martha did, full of grief, but full of faith at the same time, sometimes unable to tell which is which. We believe. Help our unbelief. Meet us, Jesus, in the places of our loss, in the places of our grief, in the places of our transition, in the tombs that we're afraid to approach. Come and be here with us. Weep with us. Call us out of our darkness. Help us to unbind each other. Jesus, teach us to descend together and to rise together. For your glory, for the sake of those still watching, still wondering if you are who you say you are. In the name of the one who is the resurrection and the life, we pray. Amen.